I'm Christopher Lydon at lunch with the pro-stylist Nicholson Baker, who every other book or so plays the high priest of literary pornography. House of Holes, his latest, may be the final proof that the critical sex organ that we all share, more or less, is the imagination. This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Nicholson Baker, you are my irresistible writer across the board. Human Smoke was pacifist history. The Anthologist went inside poetry. House of Holes, subtitled A Book of Raunch, is high porn. My first question is not why you write it, we'll get to that, but how you get away with it. The Marquis de Sade wrote something like your stuff and gave the world the nasty label sadism. John Updike wrote it lyrically, and still people, especially women, called him a phallocrat and a dirty old man. You write it in Vox and Fermata and now House of Holes, and Katie Royfe writes, after lunch with you, that she wants to protect you. She can't imagine someone as decent, thoughtful, gentlemanly as Nicholson Baker.
Well, we had a nice conversation. What can I say? It was a pleasant lunch, and she's a very generous person. I think that's the answer to that. I don't know. I think Updike did get away with it in the sense that there were these times when he would write a specific book and people would object. But his whole... part of his allure was that he was willing to write about these secret things, and especially infidelity and nervous-making things in a new way with a very high literary polish. And I think he got away with it for many, many years. I just don't want to write about the bad parts of sex. I'm not interested in it. So the Sade stuff just doesn't do it for me. I'm not interested in writing about infidelity. I'm just simply want to write about sex, you know, just on its own.
Updike and I talked about this on the radio. I think all women should read Updike. Many of them did, but almost none of my acquaintance admit that they admired him. On the other hand, with you, Elaine Blair, in the New York Review of Books, says that House of Holes, which we'll get to it, is set in a rambunctious sort of sex theme park. She said it lives inside a magic circle of wholesomeness. Not to mention the Cosmo Girls review. She said reading House of Holes is like listening to Bolero. My point is only that you finessed the feminist objection to all this.
I think maybe in this book, or maybe it's really just that we are in a different era. It's now 2011. Everybody has moved along. We've all seen a lot of stuff on the internet, and maybe some of the old objections are getting a little stale. So maybe I don't think it's necessarily that I try to be wholesome because I'm not interested in the darker forms of sex. But I did get in trouble a little bit with the Fermata, which was about a man doing impermissible things. He could stop time, and he did sneaky things. He took off women's clothes. He wasn't asking them permission. So in that book, I did quite justifiably get into trouble with people, including my wife, who said, this is a man who's doing something very wrong, and he should be punished. But this book, people just get sucked down a straw or go through a dryer in a laundromat. Some sort of hole or portal opens up, and they're in a place where the rules don't apply and where they can really just let it happen.
Name it for a couple days.
Yeah.
All of the sex in the House of Holes is consensual. I think another thing that disarms women is that you have many female points of view here.
Well, the most fun I had actually in writing the book was when I would write a scene that was mostly from the woman's point of view, because I have written these two sex books that are from Vox was a conversation, so I would alternate, but I know how I think, and the fun of it and the erotic charge of it was imagining my way into what I hoped would be a true account of what a woman was thinking. Those were the scenes, oddly enough, in a kind of oddly hermaphroditic way, got me most charged up. And I don't know what that says. Maybe there's some sort of midlife crisis I'm going through without even knowing it.
You have not been, I think, to the House of Holes. I don't read this as a sort of journal or memoir.
Well, yeah, no, I certainly didn't, because it's physically impossible to be there, and all the things that happen, there are people who get crotchal transplasmic substitutions, and, you know, a guy wants a larger piece of equipment, he gets it. A person says, I like this guy. This woman says, I like this guy, and then they watch the video, and the guy says, I really like a very large, jiggly ass, and so... The woman says, "Well, let's do that to me." And so they affix the suction cups. So all those things are physically impossible. That hasn't happened to me, but in the basic sense, of course, it all happened to me, because I would get up in the middle of the night, or I would be working in the middle of the day, and I would think, "What is the craziest, dirtiest, weirdest, horniest thing that I can think of right now?" My job, my duty, my sacred Faulknerian duty as a writer is to put it on the page. And that's what I did.
I take it that for obvious reasons you haven't done a lot of library or radio readings out of this book.
Well, you know, I haven't done any. And I have, on radio interviews, they sometimes pick a little passage. I feel that the dirtiness of this book is overstated. Because maybe it's just that I'm like one of those quarter horses the bit has been pulled too much. But I don't see this book as being as dirty as all that. So I think there's more that can be. I think you can get two or three pages into something without it's being too objectionable for radio.
I want to put that to the test, and let listeners judge for themselves. I love a I was thinking of a passage that you might read. Where Rumpa unbuttons her shirt, but she has come to the House of Holes, this kind of other side, and is maybe unaware that she's been tested. She's been sort of x-rayed. Her mind, her desire has been x-rayed before she gets there. So Daggett re-interviews her in the flesh.
Yeah, the thing about that's an interesting point that you bring up, is that you when you're sucked into the House of Holes, you're... for a moment de-physicalized, and you run through certain tests. You run through the test of how many, if you have any bad diseases or medical conditions, and it seems also to turn off the possibility of pregnancy, which is an important thing. I never put that in the book, and I realize I should have, but of course everybody who's here it's unimpeded sex. There's no worry about consequences. You're not going to get some kind of bad sickness. You're not going to get pregnant. You're just here to find out what you really want to have happen. Anyway, Rumpa was her name, and yes, she had paid a visit to the House of Holes. The people she was staying with in New Haven were wealthy and underread. Although they were middle-aged, their minds were very young, and she couldn't take them seriously. She saw a pepper grinder in the middle of the table, and while they talked about the price of tires, she unscrewed the little knob on the top, and when it came off, she lifted the wooden part of the central spindly thing and looked inside, where she could see in the shadows of peppercorns. She thought, the peppercorns are waiting to be ground up. They're still round, like little dry planets, but not for long. Rumpa held the machine to her nose and smelled the distant sharpness of the pepper, which made her smile. And then the pepper grinder got bigger, and she jumped down into it and fell through tumbling peppercorns, and she smelled 100 dinner parties of the past. Then she was herself again, but standing on the porch outside the House of Holes. She rang the buzzer. A man with a bag on his back answered. He introduced himself. His name was Daggett. He took her into a small room with a round wooden table and, referring to a clipboard, began asking her questions. He asked her to describe her ideal man. I like men who are intelligent and witty, Rumpa said. Also, kind to animals and interested in other people and able to hold a conversation of a reasonable length. Daggett frowned and looked at his clipboard. It says here that you favor a man with a heavy, dark dick. It quotes you as saying, some things are just not possible with a small, pale dick. Where did you get that piece of information? Roomba asked, outraged. During reassembly, they do a spectrum analysis, Daggett said. They screen for diseases, of course, and comb through for lurid thoughts. What's your ideal sexual encounter? Oh, touching, kissing, caressing, Roomba said, at a loss. It says here that you would favor having three Italian airplane pilots in uniform shoot their cum loads onto your belly while you cup your clitoris with a wooden spoon. They don't necessarily have to be Italian, Roomba said. And they can be race car drivers if that's easier.
Maybe.
That's plenty long enough, yeah.
Impossible not to.
Yeah.
One might have thought that the internet had killed porn by now, just by overexposure. I have a daughter who calls it the new sex education, and she's furious about it in terms of her own daughter.
Well, is it really so? Is it something to be furious about, or is it just something to learn? We have to learn new methods of mental filtration. We have to figure out what is helpful, what's funny, what's exciting, what's true, and what's just horrible and a waste of time. But that's true in all things. If you go to a magazine rack, there are magazines that are good and magazines that are bad. If you look on TV, there's beautiful, great shows, and there are terrible shows. Lots of the things that the world pushes at us are a waste of time. So it's just another, we have to learn methods of filtering obscenity so that the good obscenity comes through.
Who's the reviewer? Another woman who wants her kids to read this and feels it's good, that they'll grow up healthier than we did.
Well, that was very nice of her. That was Ms. Blair from the New York Review of Books, and I was very pleased to read that. I mean, there's some pretty kinky things in here, but maybe they're not kinky. Maybe they're sort of innocent and folktale-ish. That was what I was hoping for. I was reading a lot of obscure Hungarian folktales, actually, and I sort of thought, when I was remembering what I think Updike's quoted John Hawkes as saying, when I want a character to fly, I just say, he flew. And that's always helped me. But when you want a character to do something, get small, get big, get a larger sex organ, whatever it might be, just let it happen. Just allow the magic to happen and then see what kind of odd social situations that creates. In one scene, I have a sort of seduction where a woman and a man meet in a hotel paying their hotel bills, and she kind of flirts with him and gives him this special gum. And suddenly he's sucked down into her purse, miniaturized, and he sees her gigantic driver's license. Whoa! And he smells her purse. He smells the lipstick. He smells the leather. And then he kind of comes to in this room, in the House of Holes, of course, and feels an odd feeling in his penis. And somehow it's been reversed, and she's tiny, and she's stuck in his urethra. I just felt that was the logical thing that would happen. If he was sucked down into her purse, what would happen if she then ended up, you know, and then she has to convince him, sort of talk him through some kind of orgasm in order to free herself from this strange imprisonment. So where were we going with that? The question wasn't,
is it?
Oh, kids should read it. So it may be. So I think she's being very kind to me by saying that kids should read this book, and I hope that someone who's young will read it and tell me if will reassure me that it hasn't traumatized him or her.
I don't think I'm traumatized, Nick. I enjoyed it hugely. It's very, very funny, as only you can be funny. I mean, you're not working from a thesaurus here either. You're making up these descriptors. His United Parcel, her Snatch Patch, his Pollock, her Simmering Chicken Shack, his Pulsing Hellhound, is Malcolm Gladwell. Have you heard from Malcolm Gladwell?
No, and I meant it entirely in a flattering way. I meant to say, well, what happened, you know, this is the kind of thing that happens in the middle of the night when you're writing something like that, is my character was talking about edging, which is a practice I hadn't known about, but you read about these things on the internet anyway. And he's talking about the tipping point. And so 5 lines away, when I had to come up with a new word for what he hauled out his, and then I paused and thought, Malcolm Gladwell. I mean, it was obvious that you would want to type that. So I meant it only to be an homage to the phrase tipping point and to be a flattering reference to him, and I'm not sure how he's going to take it or what he thinks.
Of course, I'd read Vox, as Bill Clinton and millions of other Americans had, but there I was thinking of you as the author of Human Smoke, too, a magnificent compilation of insight refined by you into the 20th century history of weapons of mass destruction. I think of you also as the anthologist. I have this impression that your mind was consumed with Swinburne's rhymes and Kipling's 4-beat rhythms. And suddenly, ooh, he's thinking about other things too.
I am thinking about all those things, just not at the same time. I mean, I think we all are.
Aren't we all? Yeah, I was going to say.
We've all got these layers of self, and at a period where you think, well, I'm just going to give myself over to whatever it is, to learning how to drive or drawing, learning how to sketch a tree, a botanical illustration, or the history of war. But there's just times of your life where you think, well, I'm just really going to think really hard about it. I'm really going to fill my mind with the most graphic, interesting sexual imagery I can possibly find. I'm going to really go overboard with that. At least that's what happens to me. So isn't the job of a novelist to be true to all of these different rooms in the house of fiction? I mean, all these different places. They're not really compartments because they leak. You can't. You're not entirely doing the history of World War II every day when you write that book. You're also living your life and driving your kids to school and all that stuff. But the book is a kind of concentrated distillation of that activity. But then, you know, you're also being a sexual person sometimes. All those things happen. So isn't the job of the novelist to include them all and to kind of confuse everyone with the fact that life is confusingly kaleidoscopic?
Nicholson Baker, you may be best known now for the worthiness that you bring to Raunch, but my idea, starting again, is Nicholson Baker is the great omnidirectional noticer in our world today. You write about Kindle, you write about pacifism, about libraries, about the saving of newspaper archives. You know music, you know history, you're always funny, you're always irresistible. If you're in the New Yorker, I read you first. On anything, how would you describe, overall, the Nicholson Baker Project?
Chris, that's a flabbergasting resume, and
it's understated.
I think that the Nicholson Baker Project, that's a grand way of saying the project of any writer, which is to say, all right, I've written about this thing, I've colored in this little square, and it's time to do something new. It's time to strike out. It's time to... Because there's so much to write about. I mean, there's so little time and so much to talk about that I like to jump around. I feel it's both more fun for me as a writer and also truer to the way we experience life, which is messy. And one, there's not one kind of book that follows another or one kind of article that follows another. There's lots of things that happen in close succession that don't necessarily fit together.
I know a little bit of where you come from, Rochester, New York. You played bassoon with the Rochester Philharmonic. You went to the Eastman School of Music before Haverford. But where are you coming from, would you say, literarily?
The big moment for me literally came when I was around 16 or 17, and I read Nabokov's story. I thought it was a story, but it turned out to be a nonfiction piece of about going to the beach, and it's called First Love, and it's a beautiful description of a train ride, and it talks about the telegraph wires, and it's there was so much truth packed in there. It just seemed miraculous, and that I think made me think that there was something to this whole world of trying to describe things and tell the truth about things that was maybe closer to what I could do than the composing and bassoon playing that I was quietly failing at. I was not a natural musician, and yet I really wanted to be a composer. Maybe all writers are people who failed at something else, I don't know. But that's what happened, is I Nabokov reading him, reading some Borges, reading then some Updike and a bunch of other writers, just convinced me that there was a lot being said, and that there was some little corners left still unsaid. And that it was more exciting in a way than what I thought, what I took to be the world of avant-garde music, with its sparsely attended auditoriums and the general problem of nobody really cares if you've written a new symphony or piano sonata if you're a composer now. It doesn't matter. But then the New York Times Book Review was just fat. It was chunky with ads. People were excited about books, high-toned books and schlocky books and everything in between. And that seemed like the world I wanted to be a part of.
Mezzanine was your first, observing paint surfaces and tiny details of a walk at lunchtime. Suddenly I'm just thinking of that Nabokov story, which is all about the plush and the paint on a car going from Petersburg eventually to Biarritz, I think, right?
Yes, good remembering. Yes, exactly.
And the girl on the beach. But so interesting. What else instructed you over the years, inspired you, challenged you?
Poetry. I learned a lot from reading poetry when I was first working on Wall Street when I was 23. My lunch hour was sort of the time where I learned things, and I did a lot of copying out of writing. I learned to write by copying out other people's writing into commonplace books, and I still do that, actually. There's nothing better than reading an E.B. White essay, a beautiful essay about being in Florida in some shack, and then copying the whole thing out. You find that there's nothing, all the things that you loved about the essay are still there, but there are dozens of other little things that you hadn't noticed. It's what the painters used to do when they would go to a museum and copy a Claude or a Poussin, and they would see then how the shadow fell on the corner in a specific way that they hadn't been able to see when they didn't first have to paint it, first have to become the apprentice to the painter.
What else have you entered in your commonplace book in the last 12 months, for example?
Well, the last thing I copied out was an entire essay by E.B. White. I don't usually copy out a whole thing, but I decided recently that that's what I wanted to do, was start at the beginning of something and copy out all the way to the end, because what I used to do is find a passage I really liked, and I'd only copy out that passage. But it's interesting to find the less successful passages on either side and ask yourself, are there things that are good in those? I copied out Updike into commonplace books. I for a while resisted it because he was the most successful American writer, and his level of finish and polish is so high, and he's so good that I avoided copying him out. In fact, when I was writing my book about Updike called You and I copied out a lot of Henry James. So, because I was trying to think, okay, if I'm going to write about Updike, I've got to have some serious canonry here. You know, I've got to be filled with the essence of a person who could use language at the level of Updike. I don't think we're going to see that in English for a long time. That level of prose writing horsepower is what he had, and I don't have anything like it. I struggle and rewrite, and I try, in fact, to be simpler in a way than he is, because I know I can't compete with him. But I think that Henry James could have. I think they could have gone toe to toe, and that would have been actually an interesting smackdown.
Yeah. How many times a month do you, like me, say, what would Updike think? What would he be thinking about Barack Obama? What would he think about the death of Steve Jobs? What would he think about the Red Sox collapse?
I do sometimes think about that, and there's that feeling that every person has as you get older, where the people who are your references fall away, flake away, and you're left with your own self, and you realize that I would think that if I were Updike and I was alive now, I would be terribly, terribly disappointed with Barack Obama. I was, you know, Updike wrote how admiring he was, and would he be so admiring now? I can't imagine that he would be. How would he have politely but devastatingly framed his disappointment? That's something we can't know.
Does the technologist, does the Kindle reviewing Nicholson Baker have thoughts we should know about Steve Jobs?
Well, I admire Steve Jobs a lot, and I'm terribly sad that he's gone. I'm in the midst of writing a piece right now trying to say that in more sentences than what I just said. The problem with when people, a great person dies, my reaction is, I'm sad. I was sad about Updike when he died. I'm sad about Steve Jobs. And I think the obituary writers seem to be able to be sad in a Corinthian capital kind of way. They let lots of things happen when they're sad, and lots of sentences come out of it. I seem to close down. So I admire the man because he did so many great things, and he made using machines fun, and he made them not seem like machines because they're ways of doing art. He helped us discover all kinds of music that we wouldn't have found before, and edit movies that wouldn't have been edited in quite that way. And he certainly found new uses for aluminum. So I love the man, honestly. I love everything about him, even his prickliness and his difficultness and the fact that he called people bozos and things. I think that was part of his sort of early middle-aged, that tantruming kind of thing when he came back to Apple and fired all those people. An amazing thing to start a company and make something huge when you were just doing things with your pal after dropping out of college. Another kind of totally different amazing thing to come back to an enormously successful company that was struggling and make it so much more successful. So you have a miracle of being the creator of a company, and then the miracle of being the rescuer of the company, the same guy coming up with all these things. I think the iPhone is, I wrote this in a piece not so long ago, that the three contributions that America has made to world civilization are Some Like It Hot, the iPhone, and the New Yorker. But everybody has his own list, I said. But the iPhone has to be on it somewhere.
Some Like It Hot, the iPhone, and the New Yorker. That's a good list.
I think three helps because you want to imply the vastness of the choices you're pulling from, the vastness of the possible field of choice.
In October 2011, Nicholson Baker, why aren't we on Wall Street occupying it? Should we be?
Well, part of me says yes, of course we should be. I support these. I am impressed and amazed by the people who are doing that. I feel that where I'm dropping the ball is going. I'm not going to Washington and protesting the 10th anniversary of the war. Because I think if you're going to look at the kind of crimes or horrible things that have happened, the fact that people, white-collar criminals, did things to enrich themselves is something that has happened always. It's a terrible thing, and we want to say, we want to hold that up to disapproval. But the fact that we're still flying these unmanned drones around Afghanistan is something that is so troubling. It's so paralyzingly awful that in a new administration, more drones are flying around. So what I think I should be doing, and I don't think I can do it, is going down to Washington and refusing to leave. Being there with the Code Pinkers, those women who are amazing, and everyone else, and saying, it's been 10 years in Afghanistan that you've been killing civilians with robotic machines from the sky. Let's just end this now. You person we thought were reasonable, end it now. Tell those drones to come home. That's much more urgent in my own mind than the economic malfeasance of people who ran big banks.
I'm always wondering what a young writer feels he's joining in the way of a club with his books, and how your club, real, imagined, historical, living, has evolved.
I think you make these you have these little constellations of names, I often forget them, but the ones that come back to me are people like Samuel Johnson, Thomas De Quincey, Nabokov, and the long-winded lady Maeve Brennan, who are watchers, observers, and who do their best to tell the truth on the page. Then I get to inhale some of that, and so that club, that kind of fictitious arrangement of human beings from all times, I'm happy to try to not to join the club, but to watch them at work. That's sort of my Algonquin round table is all these writers from a long time ago.
Nicholson Baker, I have to say, you're the man. You're my man. It's a joy to read you. Pornography, too. It's a great privilege to gab with you now and then. Thank you. Thank you for House of Holes. Thank you for this conversation.
Thank you, Chris, for all these byways, and I love being on your show always.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feedback on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.